at 4:55 and 11:55 each weekday in the prime time. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. We go now to Taking Aim, Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. Over these last few months, this audience has, I'm sure, enjoyed the fact that we've been able, finally, to bring this broadcast to you in high fidelity. That high fidelity for this one time is not obtainable by either us or our friends at KPFA. We apologize for the fact that we're going to conduct the program this one time over phone lines, but as ever, we know the loyal listeners to Taking Aim feel the information merits the adjustment. Stay tuned for Taking Aim.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, September 17th, 2002. Before President George Bush went before the General Assembly at the United Nations on September 12th, there had been a report produced by the Carnegie Endowment for the Advancement of Peace, and it was a proposal for, quote, coercive inspections, end quote. The 60-page document drawn up by retired American generals, former weapons inspectors and others had urged the Security Council to set up a powerful multinational force to bring back its inspectors to Iraq. This was reported in the Telegraph in Great Britain today, September 17th. Now, today's program for Taking Aim is the Trojan Horse, UN role in Iraq. And if we look at what this report from the Carnegie Endowment for the Advancement of Peace and the role of the inspectors in Iraq over the years and the proposed role, we will see that they're setting up nothing but a Trojan horse. For as the Carnegie Endowment for the Advancement of Peace, and peace, by peace they mean war, the report goes on to say that the force, the military force, should be between 20 and 50,000 troops deployed in Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Kuwait, equipped with helicopters, armored vehicles, fighter jets, bombers, AWACS for electronic surveillance, and that these troops would escort the monitors, the inspectors, the UN inspectors, and that they would be called on at short notice to fight their way into suspect sites if the inspectors were obstructed. The purpose? The purpose is to have a UN label for a force that is acceptable for the neighboring host countries, that is the nations of the Middle East, as well as the European countries and the other members of the United Nations who would substantiate an invasion of Iraq. Because this would establish a, quote, legal, end quote, basis for a war.
Maya, actually, the charade of this entire operation is transparent when one looks at the discussions at Camp David between Prime Minister Tony Blair, otherwise known as Tony Thatcher, and George W. Bush, where Bush and Blair prepared a scenario whereby the advent of inspectors would be accompanied by a military operation, and at every point at which they were demanding access to a given area, the whole function and purpose of which is to spot out any potential defenses of government officials, of their central means of defending themselves against an armed assault, if they in any way attempted to resist this, that there would be a casus belli seen in that very fact, and that there would be troops with the inspectors for the purpose. This was worked out prior to the speech by Bush at the United Nations, and in that regard, it's instructive to examine what the role of Scott Ritter had been, because Scott Ritter has been pilloried in the mainstream media, of course, because of the fact that he's blown the whistle. He's exposed what the so-called inspectors were really doing in Iraq.
Well, we should say that Scott Ritter had been the chief United Nations inspector.
And as such, he acknowledged that he had himself been involved with the Central Intelligence Agency and with his special forces. And it's remarkable. He further revealed that all the while he was conducting inspections in Iraq, he was supplying whatever they came upon to the Israeli Mossad. A virtual statement that the purpose of the inspection was simply a mapping out of the terrain for the potential attack that was pending.
As Scott Ritter said in an article that Common Dreams has reproduced on the Internet.
It originally appeared in the Los Angeles Times on June 19th of this year.
And it's called Behind, quote, Plot on Hussein, a Secret Agenda. Killing weapons inspections would clear the way for war.
And I think that last subheading is of particular importance because what Scott Ritter has disclosed is that the design that they have in mind, we've talked about pretexts and foreknowledge, we've talked about the pea soup of deception. The whole machination involved with this is to take out one of their own inspectors, impute it to the Iraqis, and begin the attack.
Well, let's look, Ralph, at what you were saying before about who these inspectors are. What Scott Ritter reveals is that the U.S. units for the inspectors, the U.N. inspectors, that's UNSCOM, and now it has a different name, that this U.N. inspection team had been composed of Delta Force, CIA paramilitary teams, such as the Special Activities Staff.
And by the way, Special Activities Staff is spook talk for assassination units. It's an extraordinary acknowledgement here by Scott Ritter that Delta Force and CIA paramilitary and special activities operatives were the composition of the inspection teams under the aegis of the United Nations, and nothing so clearly elucidates what this United Nations facade, what this charade is. The very instrumentality for the 1.5 million civilian deaths as a consequence of sanctions is the fig leaf of legitimacy enshrined in the holy tablets of international law to sanction mass murder and genocide in Iraq, as it had in Somalia and indeed in the Balkans as well.
So when Prime Minister of Great Britain Tony Blair went to Camp David to have discussions with President George Bush prior to Bush going to the United Nations, he was bringing the message of the Carnegie Endowment for the Advancement of Peace. That is the proposal for coercive inspections. That means accompaniment of the military, or, to put it bluntly, the occupation of Iraq through the aegis of the UN inspection teams. And the British had participated in these UN inspection teams with, as Scott Ritter says, British radio intercept operators. And Scott admits that from 1996 to 1998, he was in charge of these intercept operators and, quote, which listened in on the conversations of Hussein's inner circle and the various other intelligence specialists who were part of the inspection effort.
Maya, this is what Scott Ritter stated, and it's a full quote. The Iraqi government long suspected that these inspections were nothing more than a front for a larger effort to eliminate their leader. The Iraqis would never trust such an inspection regime. And when the Bush administration leaked its covert action plan about the nature of the inspection, it was designed to oblige the Iraqi government, now confronted by the open admission that the inspection teams were an attempt to eliminate Saddam Hussein, were a spying operation, and Scott Ritter writes, the Iraqis can never trust in an inspection regime that has shown itself to be a mechanism for infiltration and manipulation by intelligence services. The true target of the CIA plan was not only Hussein, but the weapons inspection program itself, unquote. Thus, the key preparation of the full-scale war against Iraq under the pretext of eliminating so-called weapons of mass destruction was to obligate the Iraqi government to object to an inspection process which has been exposed by its actual architects as an assassination spy operation aimed at the government, aimed at the population, aimed at the very capacity of the country to defend itself against imperial attack.
Well, let's look a little at the speech that President Bush gave before the General Assembly. If you recall, Bush had said, U.S. is going to go it alone. That had been the position of Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, with the backing of Wolfowitz and Pearl and the others who were part of a think tank, a conservative, very right-wing think tank that is running the Pentagon. And what President Bush had said to the delegates of the General Assembly, which was based upon a document called the Decade of Deception and Defiance that had been prepared, is, quote, "We have been more than patient. We have tried sanctions. We have tried the carrot of oil for food and the stick of coalition military strikes. But Saddam Hussein has defied all these efforts and continues to develop weapons of mass destruction." And then he goes on, quote, "The conduct of the Iraqi regime is a threat to the authority of the United Nations and a threat to peace. Iraq has answered a decade of UN demands with a decade of defiance. All the world now faces a test, and the United Nations a difficult and defining moment. Are Security Council resolutions to be honored and enforced or cast aside without consequence? Will the United Nations serve the purpose of its founding, or will it be irrelevant?" End quote. In other words, what the United States was doing for all the members of the United Nations, and particularly to those in the Security Council, is giving them a threat. Go with us or we go alone. Are you irrelevant or are you going to join us in the invasion of Iraq?
And nothing so clearly elucidates the real character of the United Nations. And it is why we have emphasized over and over again and taking aim, and we've described the function of the United Nations as a vehicle for the legitimizing of imperial designs, that its member states have the same class composition as the United States itself. They are capitalist states. They are states with a tiny ruling class. They are subordinate ruling classes, completely dependent upon American imperialism. They are pass-throughs. They are vehicles for imposing the U.S. Design. And that has been true since the formation of the United Nations, and it requires what the Jesuits call invincible ignorance to stand in defiant understanding of the real character of the United Nations, its character in the formation of the Israeli state and the presiding over the genocidal ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, its role in the facilitating and legitimizing of the Korean War after a series of covert operations directed against North Korea, which I.F. Stone had so eloquently and precisely documented in the secret history of the Korean War, its role in legitimizing all of the depredations. The United Nations and the rape of Somalia is a paradigm of how this instrument is used. It was exposed particularly by Mark Feynman's description of the role of the United Nations in Somalia, and it delineated how the United Nations provided cover for the American operations which followed the imposition of Conoco, Amoco, Chevron, and Phillips sitting on a prospective fortune, I'm quoting from the Los Angeles Times of January 19th, in exclusive concessions of tens of millions of acres. Geologists and industry sources assert that Somalia will yield enormous amounts of oil and natural gas. The paper reports obtaining documents indicating that, quote, two-thirds of Somalia was allocated to four companies in the final years before President Mohamed Siad Barre was overthrown and the nation plunged into chaos in January 1991. The companies require United States intervention to protect their multi-million-dollar investments in Somalia. Conoco's Mogadishu corporate compound was the de facto American embassy as the Marines landed, and Mark Fineman describes how the United Nations presence was designed to provide cover for this. It was built as a historic blueprint for the United States and the United Nations to define a new world order of peacekeeping. This is a quote from the Los Angeles Times. But in actuality, what the United Nations did in Somalia was suppress any popular resistance, preside over the rounding up of people, legitimize their disappearance into detention camps, and provide for the very destruction of the country by U.S. forces. It is the classic role of the United Nations. The United Nations is a vehicle because of its class composition, because of the nature of the nations that make it up, because of its relationship to U.S. imperialism for legitimizing imperial design. That's what underlies the important article in the London Star, which says Bush will refuse to take yes for an answer. He says the trouble is that the United Nations Security Council, a body of 15 nations charged with keeping peace in the world, is subordinate to the United States and to the Bushites and their designs for Iraq. And it spells out exactly how that works. It is no different for suffering Iraq than it was for Somalia or for the Balkans, as I say.
And not taking yes for an answer is because just 4 days after President Bush, in a speech and his ultimatum to the members of the United Nations and his elaboration of 16 UN resolutions that supposedly had been defied by Iraq, on 9/16, on September 16, Naji Sabri, Iraq's Minister of Foreign Affairs, sent a letter to Secretary General of the United Nations Kofi Annan, in which he said, quote, "I am pleased to inform you of the decision of the government of the Republic of Iraq to allow the return of United Nations weapons inspectors to Iraq without conditions." Quote, "I repeat again, without conditions." And his purpose, he said, is for the Republic of Iraq to, quote, "remove any doubts that Iraq still possesses weapons of mass destruction," end quote. And he says further on that in exchange, he anticipates that after these inspections, the United Nations would lift the sanctions imposed on Iraq. So in response to this letter, what did the White House do? Scott McClellan, the spokesperson for the White House, came out and said, "As such, it is a tactic that will fail," meaning that the Iraq, in saying they would accept in the inspections, was only making a tactical step and wasn't sincere. He then went on to say, quote, "This is not a matter of inspections. It's about disarmament of Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and the Iraqi regime's compliance with all other Security Council resolutions," end quote.
Yes, Maya, it's completely consistent with the posture of the rulers in the United States from the beginning of their assault upon Iraq, from the original Gulf War. Cheney, who was in Europe to try to drum up and to intimidate government's support for the attack upon Iraq, stated explicitly to the European Union, quote, "A preventive strike against Iraq is necessary even if the country agrees to readmit UN weapons inspectors," quote unquote. The German paper Süddeutsche Zeitung commented, when Cheney gives these speeches, we are left with the choice between war, and a devastating war at that, and doing nothing. Immediate reaction to Cheney's speech was a marked intensification of criticism of U.S. policy in the Middle East, the German newspaper reports. And it's instructive as we look at the press that the Sunday Herald ran a piece that said Bush planned Iraq regime change before becoming president. It's an article published in London on the 15th of September. The journalist who authored the article is Neil McKay. Quote, "A secret blueprint for United States global domination reveals that President Bush and his cabinet had planned a premeditated attack on Iraq to to secure, quote, regime change, unquote, even before he took power in January 2001. The blueprint uncovered by the Sunday Herald for the creation of a global Pax Americana was drawn up for Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld's deputy, George W. Bush's younger brother Jeb Bush, and Louis Libby, Cheney's chief of staff, and it was a document entitled Rebuilding America's Defense, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for the New Century. It was prepared in September 2000 by the neoconservative think tank Project for the New American Century.
And, Ralph, it's a 90-page report. I remember the printer was going,
yes,
and you too can get it from the Internet.
We hold it in our hand. The report, which is called Rebuilding America's Defenses, Strategy, Forces, and Resources for the New Century, Report of the Project for the New American Century, can be downloaded, and you go to the to their internet site. The Project for the New American Century is based in Washington, D.C. It's one of the intelligence think tanks that has, along with JINSA and the Committee for a New Policy in the United States, we have disclosed in past programs, has prepared for the series of wars.
Well, going back to the PNAC document, it talks about particularly military control of the Gulf region, whether or not Saddam Hussein is in power. In other words, it's important for the United States to assure its preeminence, to have control of the Middle East, because as we've elucidated on one show after another, the U.S., this is a war for pillage and plunder, control over resources.
But I'd like to say, Maya, that you and I both sometimes fall into the common habit of referring to the U.S. When we really should make very clear here that we have as much right to our country as those who debase it. We're really talking about that tiny little oligarchy, the 2% of the population that owns 90% of the wealth, that has long since hijacked the government, the capitalist ruling class that pursues this plunder, that requires war, that depends upon an arms budget and an ever-increasing military outpouring, like an addict needs his fix, that terrorizes the peoples of the world, and no less the people of the United States, through contrivances such as 9/11 to sustain this policy of war ad seriatim against 60 countries. Cheney outlined 60 countries, one-third of the membership of the United Nations, as countries that were targeted by the United States, that required military intervention by the United States.
Yes, as Dick Cheney said, quote, there is a terrorist underworld out there spread among more than 60 countries, end quote. And that was his speech, his notorious speech to the veterans of foreign wars in Nashville, Tennessee on August 26th. And yes, Ralph, that is correct. Is there some reason I hear our music? Hello? Well, I think we should still be on the air, so I'll continue talking. As a matter of fact, Ralph, today I was at a rally of two significant unions in the Bay Area, SEIU Local 790, service employees, and also the Professional and Technical Engineers Local 21. They are the municipal employees in the city of Oakland, and they have been working without a contract for 4 months. In fact, the city of Oakland hasn't even made any offers to them. And at this rally was a representative from the ILWU, which our listeners, I'm sure, are aware, is in a major contract battle. So when we talk about U.S., we are talking about U.S. rulers, not people you and me.
I'm sorry, folks.
I'm hearing music, so I assume you're hearing music, and it's hard to talk over it.
Well, we'll make our best effort, because at full blast volume, we're hearing the recording that introduces the show and ends the show, and we'll try to make ourselves heard over the music, and we hope our audience is hearing us and not just the music. I wanted to make reference to a very important conference that took place at the University of Georgia in April of 1997, when Defense Secretary William Cohen, the Defense Secretary of then-President Clinton, addressed the subject of terrorism, which was the rationale for the conference. And he had with him James Woolsey, who was the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and they outlined how they had to prepare for biological warfare across the planet. And in particular, they set forth the agenda, which they called one of an American forward policy of removing threats. And primary amongst these was the government of Iraq, and right behind it was the government of Iran. And indeed, one of the instructive things about this blueprint, which is in 1997, for the elimination of the government of Iraq and Iran, and for their fragmentation and for the seizure of their resources, was a very particular reference to the World Trade Center as a target of international terrorism. This is 1997, brothers and sisters, at a conference at which the Secretary of Defense, then of the Clinton government, and the head of the Central Intelligence Agency were present. And they outlined the designs of the U.S. rulers for attacks upon Iraq and upon Iran. And they talked about the danger of international terrorism attacking the World Trade Center. And they outlined in this conference, and they identified 120 cities in the United States that would be subject to terror attack. This is a blueprint, all right, but it's a blueprint of the rulers who were preparing to terrorize the American people, as we have sought to demonstrate in many a document and in many a program. And the delineation of this agenda of chemical and biological warfare, of anticipated attacks on no less than the World Trade Center and on 120 cities in the United States, as a rationale for a program of continuous war, it is not just the brainchild of the Bush crowd. It is not just Mortimer Snerd and his handlers who are engaged in this enterprise. This is a resort of the U.S. rulers as they face the fact that they are dependent upon military production, and that they are aspiring to control the oil and natural gas of Central Asia and of the Middle East.
In fact, our demand is no imperial war for pillage or plunder. This is the purpose of this war. This is the purpose of the invasion of Afghanistan. This is the purpose of control over the Middle East, as we discussed in prior shows with the Odidinon strategy for Israel in the 80s.
Yes, this was the Mossad document that was prepared in 1979 and 1980, which called for the fragmentation of each Arab country in its turn into its ethnic and religious components, with Iraq at the top of the list, not just Arab countries, I should say the countries of the Middle East, because Iran, of course, which is a Farsi country, a Persian country, was the primary amongst targets. Iraq, Iran, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, each country in its turn to be fragmented and decomposed, and its resources allocated as the imperialists required. Now, this blueprint for the fragmentation of each country in its turn, which became the guiding documents for such things as JINSA, the Jewish Intelligence Network, which was discussed in such detail in The Nation, and the conservative and neoconservative councils which are associated with JINSA and the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation, are not alone in projecting this scenario, but they are critical to it.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, and we're coming to you over WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial in New York and on the Internet at www.wbai.org. You can reach us by email at takingaim@pacbell.net. That's PACBELL. Writas Press, Post Office Box 6345, Vallejo, Vallejo, California 95591. Or call us at 552-9995. That's 707-552-9995. You can call the switchboard at WBAI, and they can give you our address and email also. Now, we had talked a few weeks ago about Claude Amigambi, who is the spokesperson of the Workers' Party in Togo. And Claude, who has been leading a mass campaign for democratic elections with groups involving many unions and associations called What Solution for Togo. Claude had been arrested and falsely charged, and many of you came forward with your support. And I want to tell you what happened at the trial. He had been accused of defaming the president, the general, Adeyemo, in Togo. Writing an article that, in fact, Claude hadn't written, and the person who wrote it had come forward to mention that he's the one who had put forward this article. Still, Claude was found guilty for something he didn't do. He was given 4 month sentence, but the prosecutor has appealed and wants 4.5 years. So please continue to send your support to us at takingaim@pacbell.net.
Claude Amigambi is a distinguished writer and journalist. He's the editor of the Workers' Party's newspaper and of a book called A New Future for Togo. He published a very important book documenting the torture that is characteristic of the government in Togo. The article in question, which was written by somebody in exile, and a very important article, which exposed the corruption of the president and his son, did not happen, as Maya mentioned, to be written by Claude. They are victimizing him because he's accessible to them. It requires mass mobilizing, and it requires international support to save his life, because in prison, under torture, he's not likely to survive.
And I'd like you to know that in prior years, when the Secretary General of the Trade Union Federation in Togo had been also falsely accused, it was international solidarity that got him out of prison. So please send your solidarity to us at takingaim@pacbell.net.
And we have had the privilege of working both with Brother Norbert and with Brother Claude in international work over many, many years. They are extraordinarily courageous and capable people. Their lives are in jeopardy. Norbert now not so, but certainly Claude in his turn.
Now, our program today is Trojan Horse, the UN role in Iraq. And what we are referring to is the, quote, coercive inspections planned for Iraq as proposed by the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, and also proposed by Prime Minister Tony Blair to President Bush as a way, if there were to be inspection, a way that they would be carried out. And this involves 20 to 50,000 troops. Now, already 30,000 U.S. troops and British troops and Turkish troops are surrounding Iraq. And that's what we have documented over the past weeks and has been in the various European press. I found out, though, that there are 60,000 U.S. troops in South and Central Asia that can easily get to the Iraqi region. And this was put forward by Esther Schrader on September 10th in the Los Angeles Times. And I suggest you go to this article because it is a very detailed presentation of the U.S. fighting force in the Middle East. And I'm sure Esther got this from the Pentagon itself. And among the forces, she says, quote, The sheer tonnage of U.S. tanks, fighting vehicles, armored personnel carriers, and other heavy equipment already standing at the ready in Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and elsewhere in the Middle East is startling. And she says, she quotes Army Secretary Thomas E. White, who said that, quote, "We have done a lot with pre-positioned stocks in the Gulf, making sure they're accessible and that they're in the right spot to support whatever the president wants to do," end quote. So included in this is a new $200 million Army headquarters that opened this year in Arifjan, south of Kuwait City, and it's going to be a permanent home for 10,000 Army personnel. Who had been at Doha early in the year. 9,000 troops are intended to pair up with equipment that's already in Qatar and Kuwait and could be airlifted from bases in Georgia and Texas here in the United States, ready for action in 96 hours. And Special Forces troops are positioned throughout the region, and their locations are a secret, according to Esther Schrader.
Maya, this is the real subtext of the reports throughout the world about how the United Nations supports wars. The Sunday Herald wrote on the 15th of September in London, "Versus Victory, United Nations Supports War, the prize of winning full United Nations backing for swift military action against Saddam Hussein's Iraq is within the grasp of Tony Blair and George W. Bush. Unprecedented fast-track unanimity within the 15-nation Security Council. It details the arm-twisting, the bullying, and the threats which led to a complete collapse of the putative opposition to a preemptive U.S. attack." The same description in the Age, published in London, U.S. wins crucial backing on Iraq. And what's instructive as well is a reference in one of the articles to a commission of Donald Rumsfeld that was formed in 1998, which was presented as a doctrinal shift for U.S. intelligence gathering, and its motif. And it's a quotation here from U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and his deputy Paul Wolfowitz, quote, "The absence of evidence will not be regarded as the evidence of absence." Think about that when you think of George Orwell. The absence of evidence does not mean that there's evidence of an absence. In short, no matter what there is, they'll make it up as they go along. And the specific reference is to Iraq's, quote, "weapons of mass destruction."
Well, as Rumsfeld says, and I may not have this correct, he says, "We know what we know, we know what we don't know, we don't know what we don't know," and it goes on. That's pretty much the similar. So you can never win. Now, referring again to the arm twisting, on September 17th, there's an article by Carolyn Overton, a Herald correspondent. This is the Sunday Herald, British Sunday Herald. Their correspondent in New York, quote, "Arab leaders tell Saddam, you're on your own. Iraq has been deserted by its Arab neighbors, most of which appear willing to back a United Nations sanctioned strike on Baghdad." And she goes country by country. The Saudi foreign minister, Prince Saud al-Faisal, said his country was "obliged to follow through if military action was sanctioned by the U.N., And Hosni Mubarak, the Egyptian president, who, by the way, receives the largest military aid outside of the Zionist state of Israel, Hosni Mubarak has told Iraq, quote, "to seize the opportunity for new weapons inspections, quote, to avoid serious repercussion." And then there is Jordan, which right now is the beneficiary of the sanction because it gets a very low price on oil. It's getting all its oil from Iraq and receives much aid from the United States for its support for the U.S. incursions in the Middle East. The Jordanian foreign minister, Marwan Muasha, said Iraq should also, quote, "have immediate and full implementation of all Security Council resolutions," and Bahrain, of course, where U.S. Troops are stationed, said, quote, "to avoid any confrontation that may threaten the people of the region and the unity and integrity of Iraq, Iraq should comply with whatever the U.S. is."
All of this is a charade. after all, what we're talking about here are weapons of mass destruction, all right, in the hands of the United States of America. The chemical and biological weapons that came into the possession of the government of Saddam Hussein were each and every one of them supplied by the United States government. The Senate Committee report of 1994 of the Senate Committee on Banking of Donald Regal was absolutely explicit about this. From, and I'm quoting, from 1985 through 1989, a veritable witch's brew of biological materials were exported to Iraq by American suppliers. The Department of Commerce documented what these items were. Bacillus anthracis, the cause of anthrax. Clostridium botulinum, the source of botulinum toxin. Histoplasma capsulatum, the cause of a disease attacking lungs, brain, spinal cord, and heart. Brucella melanensis, the bacteria that cause damage to the major organs of the body. Clostridium perfringens, the highly toxic bacteria that causes systemic illness. Clostridium tetani, a highly toxigenic agent that attacks the internal lining of the body. Escherichia coli, genetic materials which affect human and bacterial DNA. Dozens of pathogenic biological agents sent to Iran by the United States government for use in its war with Iraq. Quote from the Senate report, these biological materials were neither attenuated or weakened. They were sent for the purpose of use, and they were capable of reproduction. These microorganisms were exported by the United States, and they were, and I'm quoting from the report, identical to those the United Nations inspectors found and removed from Iraqi biological sites. So what did they do? The United States military, the United States government, supplied biological weapons for Iraq to use on Iran at the same time that the Israelis were supplying Iran with such weapons to use against Iraq. The chemical and biological warfare is that of the United States and its agents. The Iraqi regime was merely the pass-through vehicle for this. And this is in particular, I want to make this particular point emphatic. Much has been made by the mouthpieces for the Bush regime of the events at Halabja when the Kurds were subjected to poison gas. This has been imputed to the government of Saddam Hussein. The realities are very different. Chief of the Central Intelligence Agency desk, Iraqi desk at Langley Field, throughout the 1980s, was Stephen Pelletier. When he left the Central Intelligence Agency to lecture at the American War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, he was sent in 1988 to investigate Halabja. And he prepared a report which was confirmed by the Defense Intelligence Agency that the Kurds who died at Halabja were killed by a cyanide gas which was in fact used by the Iranians, not the Iraqis. I repeat, by the Iranians, not the Iraqis. The Iraqis had used a mustard gas supplied by them to the United States against Iranian troops. And Iran then used the cyanide gas in Halabja that resulted in the deaths of 100,000 Kurds. It is Pelletier and the Defense Intelligence Agency which have documented, and Pelletier has written a book on the subject and has produced a 90-page report. It was a book published by Prager in 2001, and it's called The International Oil System, Why America Went to War in the Gulf, by Stephen Pelletier, a former director, chief of the CIA Iraqi desk at Langley Field, a lecturer at the American War College, a collaborator with the Defense Intelligence Agency in documenting the realities of Halabja and the gas poisoning of the Kurdish victim people of Halabja. It was an Iranian operation. It was gas supplied by the Israelis, along with the biological agents that were supplied by the United States government. Weapons of mass destruction, we know the author of those. They are our rulers who seek blood for oil, who seek a war of plunder and of pillage with terrible suffering, with 1,500 sorties of weapons of real mass destruction inflicted on the Iraqi populations of Baghdad, of Basra, of Mosul, of Kirkuk, the suffering people of Iraq. 1.5 million people dead as a consequence of sanctions imposed by the United Nations that rolls its eyes to heaven as it proposes to police the Iraqi population for its presumptive violations of what is called international law, Orwell is turning over in his grave.
More than 567,000 children in Iraq have died as a consequence of the embargo. Almost a million children in southern and central Iraq are chronically malnourished, according to UNICEF. Philippe Hefnick, the UNICEF representative in Baghdad, said, quote, "What we are seeing is a dramatic deterioration in the nutritional well-being of Iraqi children since 1991. He says it in the understated way that UN employees speak when you talk about starvation.
And depleted uranium and biological agents that were inflicted across Iraq and continue to be such by the United States itself.
Now, in terms of depleted uranium, during the Gulf War, the U.S.-led aggression of 1991, in which there were 30 countries, in fact, participating, thousands of tons of laser-guided bombs and uranium-tipped weapons were dropped, exploded, burnt throughout Iraq. That's an explosive power equal to 7 Hiroshima atomic bombs, 7 Hiroshima A-bombs on Iraq. Now, UNICEF has studied the impact in terms of the health of the children in Iraq. And a report from UNICEF shows that 54% of children suffered from diarrhea, 43% were infected with respiratory diseases, and that children between the ages of 6 and 11 had to leave school to get jobs to support their families because the economy of the country was devastated, thrown back to the Middle Ages, as Mata Atasari had said.
The 14th century. Never had he seen such a total devastation as was inflicted on Iraq by the saturation bombing with Indergel and implosion weapons that suck the oxygen out of the air and pull people's lungs out of their bodies. 200,000 Iraqi civilians in Greater Baghdad alone who died agonizingly as a consequence of that bombing.
Now,
the destruction of Basra, the destruction of the country at large, the destruction of its water supply, its hygienic facilities, its sewer capacity, its food production, total devastation, a genocide. And that is what is designed again. That is what is being prepared again. That is what the peoples of the world are being terrorized with, the prospect of another war of annihilation against the suffering people of Iraq.
Now, there is a series of studies that have been done throughout Basra by physicians, and one of them, the effect of DU and war pollution on the Iraqi new generation, is by Dr. Selma Al-Taha from the College of Medicine and the University of Baghdad. And what she reports, quote, "Abnormalities affecting the skeletal system, especially shortening of the long bones or malformation of the limbs, have shown an increase in such cases, which have resemblance to cases born to veterans in America after the Gulf War. Metabolic disorders that are due to enzymatic deficiencies also show increase in post-war samples. Ancelepathy and hydrocephaly have been increasing." That means, where the brain is all swollen. "Malformations affecting the eyes are prominent, and congenital cataracts and other diseases." And again, these are abnormalities that are showing up in Gulf War veterans, too.
Maya, the myth of an Iraqi nuclear capacity was definitively set forth in the Toronto Sun on September 15th with the headline, "Seven's Nukes Are a Western Myth." And it cites Britain's authoritative International Institute for Strategic Studies that concluded that Iraq lacked entirely the rich uranium or plutonium required to produce nuclear devices. It never had them. It never had the intention of producing them. It was certified to by the United Nations Nuclear Inspection Agency. It is a chimera. It is a fake issue. It is the pretext for a war of plunder. And it was better illuminated than by the article that appeared yesterday in the London Daily Mirror, in which it said, "Secret Bush Nuke hit list revealed. Bush's secret seven-nation nuclear hit list draws world outrage, is the headline in the article in the London Daily Mirror of yesterday by Alexandra Williams and Bob Roberts. President Bush faces world anger last night over America's seven-nation nuclear hit list. British members of Parliament have joined in outcry after a leaked Pentagon report revealed plans to use nuclear weapons against China, Russia, Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Syria, and Libya. The secret policy was denounced by Labour members of Parliament as war-mongering lunacy, unquote. The article is quite precise. The article is quite detailed. It illuminates who are the progenitors of weapons of mass destruction, who are the threat to the peoples of the world, who are threatening not just their neighbors but peoples across the planet. And if there were any doubt on this question, brothers and sisters, we need but refer to the article in the Washington Post of September 15th by Dan Morgan and David B. Ottaway, in Iraqi War Scenario, Oil is the Key Issue. U.S. drillers eye huge petroleum pool. A U.S.-led ouster of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein will open a bonanza for American oil companies long banished from Iraq, scuttling oil deals between Baghdad and Russia, France, and other countries, reshuffling world petroleum markets, according to industry officials and leaders of Iraqi opposition. Although senior Bush administration officials say they have not focused on the question of oil, the reality is that the United States is maneuvering for control over the country's huge proven reserves of 112 billion barrels of oil and their latent reserves of another 115 billion barrels of crude oil, the largest in the world outside Saudi Arabia. And this article in the Washington Post, The Importance of Iraq's Oil, has made it the administrator's biggest bargaining chip in obtaining backing from the United Nations Security Council and Western allies for, quote, tough international action, unquote, against Hussein. All five permanent members of the Security Council, the United States, Britain, France, and China, have international oil companies with major stakes in a change of leadership in Baghdad, the Washington Post continues. It's pretty straightforward, said former CIA Director R. James Woolsey, one of the leading advocates of forcing Hussein from power. France and Russia have oil companies and interests in Iraq. We are telling them that if they are of assistance to us, we'll work out something so American companies will allow them to have some portion. But if they throw in their lot with the opposition, it will be difficult to obtain any role for them in the new Iraq.
And in that line, the 100 Russian and U.S. oil companies are meeting in Houston next month. Now, it's not only oil companies that will benefit. There's a reconstruction of devastated companies. And let us not forget the Pentagon-dependent corporations, Lockheed, Boeing, Northrop, because as Lawrence Lindsay, head of the White House's National Economic Council, revealed in a Wall Street Journal article that was published today, the cost will be $200 billion for this war, not the $50 billion of the Gulf War, the $58 billion, of which $48 billion were paid by U.S. allies, U.S. rulers' allies, not our allies, but this time they anticipate $200 billion. Now, how can they sell this to the American people? Already, they are setting up an office, a press office, and they are funding it to the tune of $200 million. That's only one-tenth of 1% of the $200 billion. Still, $200 million to sell the war to us.
And as the London Times, in its newspaper report today, disclosed, the potential benefits for the United States of deposing Saddam Hussein will be enormous. Britain and America are attempting to secure Iraqi's oil have been attempting to secure Iraqi oil for most of the last century. Iraq has $112 billion, second only to Saudi Arabia, which is $265 billion. Saddam Hussein is the last obstacle to the United States' strategic aim of seizing its oil. This is the London Times and the Indian Express. In yesterday's date, Saddam ouster near firm's eye Iraqi oil. President Saddam Hussein's ouster will allow American oil companies to seize control of the oil market, huge reserves of 120 billion barrels, and they again quote none other than CIA former director Wilsey. It's pretty straightforward. It's pretty straightforward. The oil companies and our interests in Iraq are critical to us. And Ahmed Shalabi, the Iraqi National Congress leader, stated there will be the creation of the United States-led consortium for control over the oil fields. The American companies will have the big shot at Iraqi oil.
You are listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today has been Trojan Horse, UN Role in Iraq. Now, you can get a copy of this program from us by contacting us at Taking Aim at PacBell, PACBELL dot net. And we want to thank Mark Bilk, who has taken our last program, 9/11 False Flag Operation, and placed it on the Internet. You can find it there at www.radio4houston/911. And thank you, Radio 4 Houston, for allowing our Taking Aim program on 911 to be up there on your server.
Because we asked the question, and we pose the issue, who are the real terrorists? Who are the state terrorists that inflict war and suffering on the peoples of the world? Who is terrorizing the American people? Who is aiming for wealth and power and control over the planet at the expense of hundreds of thousands of lives? The answer is transparent. The evidence is there. We must mobilize around that truth and not repose false expectations and hope from a vehicle like the United Nations, which facilitates the conquest of our rulers.
Again, this is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. We'll be with you next week.
Thank you to Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen for more and more and more information about this situation. Just a word that I haven't heard said, a quick statement, and that is that why we are doing this now, why are we fanning these flames now? Saddam Hussein has been there for 10 years and more. Because we have so badly damaged our relationship with the Arab population, the Arab nations, with our cowboy and Indian-like corralling up of Arab citizens, Arab Americans, and anything Arab-like, that we have to end that relationship and get our oil secure. Well, there's always Venezuela, but the United States doesn't like a friendly dictator either, so... we have the evening news coming up at 6 o'clock. Here's some information about shows after midnight that pertain to weaponry from another point of view.
Pay my respects to the coalition commanders that I just met and to the members of the armed forces that are here side by side with the United States. Armed forces from other countries are shoulder to shoulder, and we are very grateful that this is a multilateral, not simply a unilateral mission. Our U.S. presence, of course, is the dominant one. And
weaponry, America's only international defense affairs, military hardware, and history talk shows heard every Tuesday night at 1:30 a.m. Tune in for in-depth, often scholarly, multifaceted analysis of the ongoing crises in Somalia, the Middle East, what used to be Yugoslavia, and some other places you haven't heard of yet except here. International security policy, electronic warfare, the next generation of Navy carrier fighters, DOD-wide force reductions, Balkans Watch with David Isby, documentaries, interviews, technical analysis, oral history, and more every Tuesday night at 1:30, only on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York.
and weaponry can be heard here on WBAI at 1:30 a.m. this morning. That's after Moorish Orthodox Radio Crusade, another informative program that starts at midnight. Before that is the 11 o'clock rebroadcast of the evening news, and going backwards from there, or forwards from 7, after the news, we'll have Tahrir, Barbara Nimer Aziz, a magazine of the Voice of Arab Nations. At 8 o'clock, a compendium of voices from the Asia-Pacific Forum. Anandruta Das directs Leila May, Andy Sao, Tomo, and others with absolutely exceptional broadcast information about the Asia-Pacific Forum.